Footsteps of the Hasidic Masters, Volume 5, is sponsored by Rabbi Irwin and Judy Katzoff, in loving memory of Shirley Katzoff, Sarah Rivka Bas Yosef, Aleha HaShalom.
We're going to be talking now about the the Rebbe of Honestipel, the name is much more familiar today to the world of Torah, because in Bnei Brak until recently, the acknowledged Godel Hador, the stipler, was someone who was known because he came from originally from the city of Honestipel. So the people didn't want to pronounce the whole thing Honestipel, so they called him the stipler. But the stipler came from Honestipel. His father was a Honestipel, a Chosid. And even though he ended up learning in the Lithuanian yeshivas, he ended up in Nevardok. But the circumstances surrounding the beginning of his life were certainly such that they had a mukir and a shalish. They had a very strong root in Chassidus. Perhaps if some of you will remind me, I will I'll tell you an interesting story about the relationship of the stipler to Ramatel. But we're going to be talking now about Ramat Chadoiv of Honestipel. Many of the anecdotes that you will be hearing will be anecdotes that I heard from my father. My father was a grandson and remembered him, although he was very young. He nonetheless remembered him. And most of the sipurim, most of the stories are the kinds of things that he learned firsthand from the people to whom they had happened. So there's a great deal of reliability to the to some of the things that I'll be repeating to you, which are extremely fascinating, to say the least. Ramatel of Honestipel was a descendant, direct linear descendant of Reb Zisha of Anapola. His father, Reb Meshulam Zisha, was the son-in-law of the Cherkasser, and we've recently talked a good deal about the Rebbe of Cherkas. The lineage from all of the very prominent lines from which he derived had a great deal of influence on this youngster. On his father's side, it was Zisha of Anapola. On his mother's side, he had his mother's father. His maternal grandfather was Chernobyl, was the son of the Chernobyl Magid, and his mother was the daughter of the Mitla Rav, who was the second Rebbe of Lubavitch after the Balatanya. So he was profoundly influenced by all of these different streams in Chassidus. Ramatala was named Ramat Chadoiv because the name Mordechai comes from the Chernobyl Magid, and the name Doiv comes from his maternal grandmother's father, the Mitlarav. So he was in his name itself you have the two greatest forces in his life, which were Chernobyl and Lubavitch. He was born in the year Tafresh, which corresponds to the year 1840 of the Common Era, and he was born on the fifth night of the fifth Lechtel of Hanukkah. His family name, ordinarily, since he was a linear descendant of Reb Zisho, should have been, or would have been, Auerbach, which means that that would have been our name, in as much as the family line, the male descendancy, comes from Reb Zisho. However, when Reb Matala was a youngster of some 6 years old, his mother passed away. And his father, Reb Shalom Zisho, married his mother's sister. Reb Matala had two sisters. It was himself and two sisters, and they were all very young children. And in an effort to give them a kind of attention that might not be forthcoming from a stepmother, Reb Shalom Zisho married his wife's sister. So there was a great deal of devotion and care that was forthcoming from her, but unfortunately she too passed away after a number of years. And so Reb Matala was once again orphaned. His father, Reb Zishala, was then spoken a shidduch with the daughter of Reb Chaim of Kosov, and this was already a very considerable distance from Hannah Stipel, where Reb Matala was born and where he grew up. And Reb Zishala went to Kosov. He eventually became rabbi in Talmadge. And the grandfather, the maternal grandfather, was Yankiv Yisrael of Cherkas, ended up raising these children. And it's for this reason that Reb Matala came to be known by the name Twersky, because essentially he was reared by his maternal grandparents, and since their name was Twersky, the name Twersky stuck. He was, as a youngster, immediately showed promise as a prodigy. His grandfather, when he recognized that the Melamed who taught him was no longer really capable of keeping up with this youngster, went and hired an outstanding Talmud Chacham by the name of Reb Shneur Zalman, who was from the city of Trillis. So Reb Shneur Zalman came to Hana Stipel, gave up his rabbinate in Trillis, and taught Reb Matala. Reb Matala at the time was 10 or 11 years old. He very quickly discovered that this youngster that he was teaching had a mind that was runaway brilliant, and with a maturity of thought that belonged to a seasoned veteran of Gemara, and began to feel uncomfortable in his role as the teacher. Nonetheless, the straw that broke the camel's back was occurred when Ramatala was about 12 years old, and a number of days before his mother's yahrzeit, he approached his Rebbe, Zvi Shneur Zalman, and said to him, "I would very much like to be Messiah Masechta Sukkah. I'd like to learn this Gemara Sukkah," which is a fairly large tome of the Talmud, in memory of my mother. So the Rebbe said to him, "Now you remind yourself. Now you want to learn this Masechta." So Ramatadev said to him, he said, "I think I can do it." So the Shneur Zalman said to him, "Okay, be my guest." So a couple of days later, he came back and said to him, "I finished." So the Rebbe said to him, I know you're bright, but didn't finish." So the youngster said to him, Ramatadev said to him, "The Rebbe can test me." So almost as a reflex, he said to him, "Okay, how many times is the name of the sage Rava mentioned in Masechta Sukkah?" So he closed his eyes, thought for a few seconds. He says, 52 times. So Shneur Zalman sat down, opened up the Gemara, counted it out, and when he found that it was there 52 times, he got up, walked into the Chikasan and said to him, "I resign." He said, I'm not capable of doing this anymore. The Chikasa recognized that from this point forward, it was highly unlikely that he was going to find someone who was going to be this youngster's equal. So he did the next best thing, and he appointed a chava. That is, there was a friend, he was a few years older than Rav Matala. And he said to him, "Learn together. You'll just learn together. You'll be a chavrusa." And he said to him, "You've got to watch over him. You got to keep track of him. I want you to be sure that he eats well. I want you to be sure that he's he gets enough sleep." This friend's name was Rafael. So, in the course of they're learning together and spending a great deal of time together. They even slept in the same room because of the instructions of their grandfather. So one night, middle of the night, this Rafael wakes up and he finds that the Matala is sitting on the floor and he's rechting up chatzais. He's reciting this portion of that deals with the lament and the grief that we should be acknowledging because of the destruction of the temple and the exile of the Shekhinah. And he followed this. He just watched, feigning sleep all the while, and he watched the Rav Matala sit there for hours. He was a youngster. Talking about a youngster of 11 or 12 years old, and he's crying his heart out. And then, shortly before dawn, he finished and got into bed and went to sleep. He'd been up all night, in fact. The next morning, the foil says to him, "Look, and I'm appointed here by your grandfather. I'm supposed to watch over you, and you're supposed to sleep. So you've got to sleep." And the Rebbe said to him, "Listen," he said to him, "do me a favor, don't squeal on me." So he said to him, "Now," he says, "I have to do this. So Ramatala said to him, "Listen, yeah, just to anything you want, just tell me, what do I need for some protection here? So this Chafoel thought it over carefully. He said to him, well, one day you're going to be a great Rebbe. I want you to let me be your gabbai. That's the deal. So the Matala said to him, he said, you're out of your mind. I'm not going to be any great Rebbe. He said, you're asking for something which is silly. So the Chafoel said to him, look, maybe I'm asking for something that's silly, but that's the deal. So the Matala said to him, okay, in the remote possibility that I ever become a Rebbe, you'll be the gabbai. And this Chafoel, on that basis, did not repeat this information until after the Matala passed away. And that's first when he felt that he was allowed to tell the story. But in fact, Reb Matala, even at that young, tender age, was already doing the kinds of things which had drawn the attention of those who knew to the fact that he was not just a gifted and brilliant prodigy in Talmud, but that he was also a youngster of extraordinary proportions in his Avedis Hashem, in his divine service. I've shared with you the story, but in as much as we're talking about the Matala now here, I think that it bears repeating. When the Matala was about 10 years old or so, a chassid of his grandfather. His grandfather at this point, you must remember, lived in Honestipel. He didn't become the Rebbe of Chakas until some years later when he left Honestipel to go to Chakas. In any event, this story still took place in Honestipel, where Reb Matala was born and where he grew up. A chassid came and demanded to see the Rebbe. The Gaboyim told him that the Rebbe was gone and that he wasn't going to be back for a number of weeks. The chassid became hysterical and asked to see the Rebbetzin. So he went into the Rebbetzin and he said to him, I came especially to see the Rebbe. I have, it's a terrible, it's an ace tzav ace, that I have a problem which is a pending catastrophe, and only the Rebbe can help me. So he pours out his heart that there's a pogatz, the guy who's the owner of all of the lands and all of the different businesses that are there, and they're leased out, the rights and the license to occupy certain or transact certain businesses leased by the pogatz. And he's had an inn, which was very common. Jews had these little motels along the way, and the license was at the leave of the poet. So he says, I didn't have a good year. He says, I can't afford to pay for my lease. He says, and it's already reached the point where the poet has sent his soldiers, and they've smashed my windows. If I don't pay the lease, if I don't pay what I owe him within a number of days, he will hold me hostage. And it was well known that once you were held hostage, it was like a death sentence. The dungeons were not places that were hospitable to life. So he said, I don't have a clue about where to get the kind of money that I owe him, and only the Rebbe can help me. So she said to him, look, the Rebbe's not home. He said, I advise you to go see my grandson, Matala. He said, perhaps he will be able to help you. So this chassid goes out and inquires about this Matala's whereabouts. And when he finds him, he says to him, look, I have to talk to you because your grandfather isn't here and I need some help. So Matala says to him, I'm just a little kid, you know, like What do you want? So he says, oh, you have to hear this story. You know, he pours out his heart to this little kid. And the Motola says to him, you know, it's a terrible story and I hurt for you. But he says, but what can I do? So this chassid says to him, look, if you really can't help me, I have no complaints. I have no tainus to you. You know, then you can't, you can't. He says, but if you really can, you really can't help me, and you're not helping me, he says, I won't forgive you, not now or forever. Not in this world or the next. And again, he just becomes, he breaks down and weeps hysterically. So the youngster can't take this, and he says to him, okay, he says, come with me to the mikveh. This was, by now, it was already after midnight. So he takes a candle, and they go to the mikveh. The mikveh on a steeple was such that you had to go down a lot of stairs. So he's holding the candle, and this little kid goes into the water. And he sees him go underneath the water. He can see his form underneath the water. And he doesn't come out. He doesn't come up for air. So he wants to go down and pull him out. But it's almost as though something was restraining him. He couldn't move. So he just stood there. And the thought began to go through his mind that the kid drowned. And now he's going to, not only does he have the problem with the Poritz, but the Rebbe's grandson, who the Rebbe was so attached to and wild about, and it was such a prodigy that the Rebbe's grandson drowned because of him. Anyway, he's standing there, can't move, holding the candle. And what seemed like hours went by, and this little body under the water didn't move. And then finally, there was a sound of the water breaking. He came out, and he said to him, you can go home now. You won't have any more problems with the parts. So this chassid went back home. He arrived early in the morning, and the parts was waiting for him. And he said to him, do me a favor, I forgive the entire debt, but just let me be. So the chassid says to him, okay, what should I let you be about? He said, last night, he said, I went to sleep, he said, and all of a sudden something took hold of my throat and was choking me. He said, I couldn't breathe. He says, and as I was thrashing about it, I began to think, why am I being punished? And the only thing I could think of was because I was persecuting him. So I said, in my head, I said, okay, I won't bother him anymore. And all of a sudden, I could breathe. So I said, nah, it's a coincidence. All of a sudden, he says, the hand was at my throat again. He said, and I was choking again. He says, when this went on, he says, a number of times, I realized that this was where it was at. So he says, I want you to know. He says, I want to live. He says, you can have this place. I won't bother you anymore for any money. A number of weeks later, the chassid came back to Honestaipel because the Rebbe, the grandfather, had returned, and he went in and told them this entire story. After the chassid left, the Rebbe summoned his grandson, the little Matala, and said to him, Matala, Matala. He said, it's quite an achievement, he says, but you're too young, he says, to have put your life on the line for a situation such as this. So that was his first maiface. That was his the first of many such extraordinary events which flowed through the life of Matala. When he was somewhere between the ages of 9 and 10, there was a an instance where his grandfather, who was in his own study, heard a great commotion. And when he went out to inquire about the commotion, they told him that it's been a number of hours already that Matala is missing. They can't find him, and they don't know whether he's been kidnapped or he's lost or what happened. In any event, they fully expected, they had been trying to keep this news from the Rebbe. They fully expected that he would, his agitation would be in the extreme. But for whatever reason, the Rebbe was not at all put out. He said, come with me and we will look for him. So they went to some of the places that they'd already visited a couple thousand times looking for him. And as they're walking, the Rebbe says, you know what, look underneath the steps. There's like a little right underneath the steps, he says, check there. So sure enough, they look in there, and there is Reb Matala sitting with a little candle and learning underneath the steps. It turns out that the reason that he was learning in the secrecy of, or the concealment of the steps was, is that he had taken out one of the Sifrei Kabbalah at age 9 to learn, and that he became so engrossed in the study of this sefer that he was oblivious to all of the screams and all of the calls when they were calling his name and looking for him. The Rebbe embraced him, and as they were walking away together, the grandfather said to Zainikol, he says, Matala, he says, there will come a time, he says, when it will be appropriate for you to learn these for him. And when that time comes, you won't have to hide. I will teach you. By the time he reached his bar mitzvah, he was already a bucky. He was already in command of the better part of the entire Talmud. And by this point, his reputation had traveled throughout the Hasidic world. And the Rebbe of Sanz, who we have spoken about the last number of weeks, the Dvar Chaim, was asked about the possibility of a shidduch between his daughter and this young prodigy from on the steiple. The Divrei Chaim readily agreed to the shidduch, and right around the time of Reb Matala's bar mitzvah, he became formally betrothed with the writing of Tnoyim to the daughter of the Divrei Chaim. When the Sanzerov was asked how he allowed himself to do a shidduch without ever having met the chosn, he said, first of all, he said, remember, he says, that my father-in-law took me sight unseen. Remember the story with Leibnikarov, the Boruch Tam, who took him at the urging of his son, who found him in a mismedrash someplace. And he says, second of all, he says, I can tell you that even though it is a great distance from here, that I can see that this youngster shines with a very, very special radiance, and I have no misgivings about the fact that I need to visit him personally in order to know what he is. At age 15, the marriage took place. Now, you have to remember that Sanz was in Galicia and that Honestaipol was Russia. So it was, first of all, it was a great distance to travel. Second of all, there was all kinds of restrictions on the rabbeim of the house of Chernobyl. In other words, all of the Turskis were prohibited by the government from traveling. Anytime they traveled, it required special permission, and that permission was rarely granted. There was a constant suggestion or an the thought was, and that had been planted in the minds of the Tsar's government, that the Turskis had such a large Hasidic following that they were capable of insurrection, of mounting a rebellion against the authority of the Tsar. So the only way that they could contain it, they felt, was to prevent the Rebbes from traveling. So the Cherkasov could not take the wedding party out of Russia. Poland, who was in where the Sons of Lviv was under the was then really under Austria, would not allow the Divrei Chaim to really leave at that time the Austrian Empire, and it was finally agreed that the wedding would take place in Husyatyn, which was right on the border. So the Divrei Chaim journeyed from Sanz to Husyatyn, and the Cherkasov, or he was then in Honestaipol, the wedding party got permission to travel as far as Husyatyn, and the wedding took place in Husyatyn. The wedding party arrived a day or so in advance of the wedding, and as the following morning, the day of the wedding, the Divrei Chaim approached his Mechutin, the grandfather, and said to Mechutin, "The dowry that I promised," which was a sizable dowry, he said, "during the course of the travels, I traveled a great distance from," he said, "wherever I traveled," he says, "I was besieged by the poor," he said, "and I distributed the entire dowry along the way." He says, "I do not have a penny." He says, "If you are insistent, then we will have to postpone the wedding until such time as I can travel to some of the surrounding communities here and raise that amount of money for the dowry." So it was very clear that the Cherkasov was disturbed by the fact that he had distributed the entire dowry and that the wedding might have to be postponed. The Divrei Chaim said to him, "I'm going back to my stancia, I'm going back to my hotel where I'm staying, and you'll let me know what your decision is." A number of hours later, there was a knock on the door, and there was a messenger from the Rebbe, that the Rebbe said that he was ready to proceed and that the wedding would take place that day. When the Divrei Chaim came, the Cherkasov said to him, he said, "I want you to know," he says, I really was very disappointed. I understand that the Mechutin wanted to take care of the needs of all of the poor who were clamoring for help," he said, "but," he says, "I was very disturbed," he said, "but he said, when I went home to reflect on how I should proceed, he said, I discovered that my father came, in other words, the Chernobyl Magid, who was already long gone at that point, and he says, my father came to me and said to me, do not cause any pain or hurt to the Mechutin, the sons of Ov. He is a man of great standing in the heavenly community, and you should just go ahead with it. So the Chikasa said, anybody who can bring my father to admonish me from the world to come is somebody that I'm not going to fool with, so let's just get on with it. And they proceeded to get married at that point in Husyatin. Before they had left Sanz for the chuppah, they became aware of the fact that the Russian government, in one of its many, many attempts to try to break the spirit of the religious community, had issued a decree against any of the brides cutting their hair in preparation for, in those days in Russia, either wearing a shaitel or putting on a kerchief. But there was, amongst the Hasidim, it was very common that regardless of whether you covered your head with a kerchief or with a shaitel, that the women would shave their heads. So the government had issued a decree against allowing that practice. So that when the Divrei Chaim learned of that, he turned to his daughter, the Kala, and said to her, you're probably going to be ending up living in Russia. What do you intend to do? So she said, I intend to do what my mother did, and I'm going to cut my hair. So he said, well, what about the decree? So she said to him, I have every confidence that you'll see to it that that decree will be annulled in advance of the chuppah. So he said, oh. And by the time they reached Husyatin for the wedding, the decree had been. After the wedding, Ramatala's hasmada, his diligence and his determination to devote himself with great concentration to his learning, if it's possible, increased even more so. In those days, they said that he was devoting between 18 and 20 hours a day to his learning. At age 18, he wrote a sefer on the laws of Netilas Yadayim and the laws of Mikvah, which, although he published it without his name being mentioned anywhere, became well known that it was under his authorship. It drew the attention of the entire Talmudic and scholarly world to him, and at the tender age of 18, the rabbinic community, not only of Europe but even of Israel, began to send their questions, their complicated halachic questions, to him, the responses to which eventually were collected and published posthumously in sefer which is extremely well thought of by the world of Lomdim, called Emek Shaila. So his reputation as both a person whose piety, whose saintliness was of the highest order, and at the same time a person who was recognized not only by the Hasidic world for his greatness, but was considered a goyin and a star by the Masnagdic world as well, set this Gematola apart as someone who had the universal veneration of the religious world. When he was 18, he paid his first visit. He traveled to Sanz to spend some time with his father-in-law. Along the way, during this journey, he managed to visit his great uncle. You must remember that the Genevala Magid had 8 sons, all of whom were Hasidic Rabbeim, all of whom were people of extraordinary proportion in their spiritual stature. One of them was Reb David Tolna. This Reb David Tolna was amongst the sons of the Chernobyl Magid. Remember, this was his grandfather, the Chikasa's brother. And this Reb David had a reputation of being a person of Solomonic wisdom. So he stopped in to spend time in Tolna. As it happened, it was Hanukkah. So he was anxious to see how his great uncle, the Rebbe of Tolna, kindled the Hanukkah lecht. So he took his place amongst the whole crowd of Hasidim, and the Rebbe came in, Dodel came in, and lit the Shamas. And as he was standing, preparing, just before he was going to say the brachas, he abruptly walked over to a Chassid and said to him, "You have a very short wife." So he said to him, "What happens if you have to communicate with her something that you don't want anybody to hear?" He said, "I would imagine you have to bend over and whisper in her ear." And he says this out loud in front of all of these. And with that, he doesn't wait for the answer. He just turns around and goes back to the menorah and lights the Hanukkah. So after this entire ceremony is over, the Chassidim, amongst whom there were a great many scholars, are standing there like struck. I mean, they just don't know what happened to them over here. I mean, it just, you know, it's a strange occurrence. So they turn to Reb Matala. They know that this Reb Matala has, a reputation of knowing not only the Talmudic world, but that he also knows the Kabbalistic world. So they go over to him and they say to him, "What just happened?" So Reb Matala says to him, he said, "Look, I don't want to take on myself," he says, "to tell you that I know what the Rebbe means, but let me speculate." He said, "There is a rule that the Shechina does not descend below 10 tefachim. 10 tefachim is roughly 40 inches. The Shechina does not descend below 10 tefachim. However, the ideal place for the Chanukah menorah is under 10 tefachim. In other words, you should not, ideally, you shouldn't place your menorah above 10 tefachim. It should be less than 10 tefachim. So he said, so we have over here a problem. He said, which is, here we have this great mitzvah where for sure the Shekhinah is present, the divine presence is there. And how does this, how do you reconcile this with the fact that the divine presence does not go under 10 tefachim? So he said, so, he says, the Kabbalah says, makes the following analogy, that, and uses this expression, that just as a husband bends over to confide in his short wife, so does the Shekhinah bend over to occupy a space underneath the 10 tefachim. So he said, the Rebbe, he said, who was about to light the candles and was in effect was drawing the Shekhinah to a place which was lower than 10 tefachim, used this Kabbalistic expression by going over and saying to him, you have a short wife, so how do you deal with it when you need to confide in her? He says, you bend over, right? So the following night, there was, once again, the Rebbe came in, Rav David Altalner came in to light the candles, and just before he lit the candles, walked over to another chassid and said some other mysterious thing, and looked up at Rav Motl and said to him, this time, you're not going to figure it out. Rav Motl was profoundly impressed by his visit to Tolna. And his visit with his father-in-law was also the source of a great many very, very intriguing sipurim, many, many wonderful stories. In the year 1860, in Tofrei Shchof, abruptly, without any indication before, his grandfather announced that they were leaving Honestipel. We have to realize that Honestipel had become a city full of Chassidim, and that there was an industry that had grown around the Rebbe. There were all kinds of hotels and motels, kinds of things where Chassidim would stay when they came to visit with the Rebbe. And all of a sudden, one fine day, he gets up and says, I'm leaving, and I'm going to resettle in Cherkass. So all of the Pnei Ha'ir, all of the dignitaries of the city began to file in, to plead with the Rebbe not to leave, and it was a terrible thing for all of the city and so on. But the Rebbe would not be dissuaded, and gathered about him his entire family, including the Motl and his wife and children, and the entire entourage moved to Cherkass. The entire community followed him as they were leaving the city, and it was for the people of the city, it was a tragedy. Even the non-Jews had grown to revere the Rebbe, and there was this caravan of tears and wailing. When they reached the port, the Rebbe stood up in the carriage that was in which he was sitting, and said, "I promise you that Honestipel will once again prosper and shine." Nobody knew what that meant, but the Rebbe had given them some kind of an assurance. So the Motala joined his grandfather in Cherkass, and I believe I shared this anecdote with you when I was talking about Chakas, but it bears repeating. 3 years after they had settled in Chakas, the Rebbe, the Chakasa, fell sick and went into a coma. And his grandson, the Matala, sat at his bed for days and days, could not be persuaded to leave his grandfather's bedside. Finally, one morning, just as suddenly as he had become ill, the Chakasa awoke and said to his grandson, "You know, a person has Ramache Vorim Shasagidim, he has all of these, he has six, when you collect it all together, there are 248 limbs and organs and 365 muscles and sinews, which correspond to the 248 positive commandments, the 365 negative commandments." He says, the spiritual and the physical reflect. And when there is something wrong in the spiritual configuration, if there's some obstruction or some pathology, then, he says, the person becomes physically ill. He said, when I fell ill, he said, I needed time to examine every one of my limbs and organs and every one of my sinews and muscles to find the origin of this illness. So he said, all of these days that I appeared to be unconscious, I was involved in this very exacting and thorough self-examination. He said, I finally reached the conclusion that it was not because of something that I was doing wrong, but my studies in Nigla, my studies in the open, the revealed Torah as opposed to the Kabbalah, had suffered as a result of my having engrossed myself in the Kabbalistic studies. So he said, so I have resolved that every day I will study so many Mishnayos and so many folios of the Gemara. And with that, he says, with that resolution, he said, my healing began. At the same time, he said to his grandson, he said, but, he says, I must tell you that the time has come that you must leave me, and you must return to Honestipol and begin your own Rabbistva. You have to now assume responsibility for your own community and your own, develop your own following. Rav Matala pleaded with him tearfully that he should not, first of all, that he should not, he did not want to be separated from his grandfather, but even more importantly, that he did not believe himself to be worthy of being a Rebbe of Hasidim. His grandfather said to him very succinctly and very firmly, "Ein malchus negas b'chavata afilu kimolei nima." One kingdom does not and cannot impinge upon another even a hair's breadth. My child, if you want me to live, then you must leave. Your time has come. So, hearing that that statement, the Matala understood that he had no alternative, and he moved to Honestipol. He arrived in Honestipol, Shabbos Nachamu, of the year Tafresh Chav Gimel, which is 1863, and for the first six Shabbosim did not speak out or hold forth in any Divrei Torah at his Shabbos Tish. It was not until Pashas Kisavai, shortly before the Yom Ha'Noraim, it wasn't until Pashas Kisavai that he said Divrei Torah at the Tish for the first time. What's interesting about that is that from that point forward, for the next 40 years, he held forth at every Shabbos Tish. 40 years later, in the year Tofresh Samach Gimel, which was 1903, Pashas Kisavai, he held forth with the very last Torah of his life. And Mitzvah Shabbos, he received some Chassidim, wrote a responsum, which he dated Eir L'Yom Aleph, which means the light to day one of the week, which is if you write anything at night, you would indicate that it was written at night by calling it Eir L'Yom Aleph, the light to the first day, even though it's Daka, but that's how you write it. Subsequently, he erased that date and wrote Moitzei Shabbos Kodesh after Shabbos, and during during that night he must have had a heart attack and passed away. 5 years before that, 5 years prior to then, one morning he awoke and he summoned his family, his children, and said to them, my uncle, Reb Dovidel of Tolna, who was already had passed on by then, came to me in a dream and told me that heaven had summoned to Reb Matalach. He says, and I was one of them. So he said he persuaded heaven to give me a 5-year extension. So, it was very clear to the children that this dream was not something that their father had dismissed as being a mere dream. And 5 years later, indeed, at the very time he passed away. Like his father-in-law, the Matala had an incredible investment in charity. He would not allow himself to rest at night until such time as all the money had been distributed. He had special pockets made in his clothes, each of which had a special designation. There was a Hachnasas Kala pocket, and there was a Matnas Aniyim pocket for the poor and for the rich. Every pocket had a special designation on one occasion. And by the way, it wasn't as though the needs of his own household were accounted for. And when he was pressed, on more than one occasion, he told one of his children, he said to them, after he had just been harangued by the Rebbetzin, he said, what is a Rebbe other than a Gabbai Tzedakah? He's a steward over the charity. He says, it's not my money. He says, I just serve as a conduit. On one occasion, the Rebbetzin came in after he had just received a very handsome sum of money, some 500 ruble, a note, some 500 for some the value of 500 ruble, and the Gabbai knew that he had just received this note. And she came in and she said to him, I need money. And he said to her, I don't have any. She said to him, but that rich chassid was just here. He said, trust me, I don't have any money. So she left. And then the gabbai looked at the Rebbe, and the Rebbe said, I know. He says, you think I just told an untruth. He says, I put the money into the Hachnosas Kala pocket. He said, if I put it into that pocket, it's not mine. I don't have it anymore. It's not mine. He says, it doesn't belong to me anymore. Took out the note, gave it to the gabbai. He says, take it over to so-and-so, who has to marry off his children, and give it to him. On one occasion, when he had no money to give, and there was a chassid there who was in terrible straits, he had silver buttons on his bekisha. He clipped off the buttons and gave it to the chassid and said to him, here, you can exchange these for a fair amount of money. On another occasion, he had always refused to allow anybody to take a photograph of him. In those days, they were already taking photographs, and he refused to allow a photograph to be taken of him. And although numerous attempts were made, he had assured his chassidim that no such attempt would ever be successful. And then one Purim, while he was sitting at the table, the photographer came in and said to him, Rebbe, because of you, I'm not going to be able to marry off my children. He was a very, very mild-mannered and a person of consummate compassion. He looked up at him and said, because of me? So he says, yes, Rebbe, if you'd allow me to take your picture, I could sell that picture to Chassidim. I would have enough money to marry off my children. So he says, so who's stopping you? And that's the only time that anybody successfully caught a photograph of them. The photograph that I have of my great-grandfather is the picture that was taken at that time. He would take his precious items and put them into hack in order to get money to give to charity. So he was my father had an older sister. She was the oldest of all the children. There were four boys and a girl. I think that's right. Four boys and a girl. My aunt Develke had come to visit when I was a youngster, and many kids, she would come to visit. She lived in England at the time. She would come to visit my father. My grandfather, Leibola, shortly after his first child, Dverke, was born, was visiting with his father, with Reb Matala. And Reb Matala said to him, so how is your Bas Yechidke? In other words, how is your only daughter? He didn't have any other children at the time. He just had this. So it could have been interpreted as simply like, you know, right now, my grandfather said that when he knew that his father was very, very careful with his verbal expressions. And if his father said, how is your Bas Yechidka, how is your only daughter? He knew that he was not going to have any other daughters. And he didn't. That was it. He didn't. Subsequently just that. Had the boys, but Matala would wake her when she was a youngster, in the middle of the night, to go and deliver charity to the poor, so that it would arrive anonymously and nobody would know where it came from. And she would repeat these anecdotes of how she would be delivering charity. His love for his chassidim was legendary. Every chassid fought with the other chassidim about whether there really was anybody whom the Rebbe loved most. And everybody had that feeling that they were the exclusive objects of that particular kind of esteem and affection from the Rebbe, because that was, it was just that that palpable and that that forceful. The Rebbe suffered from, he had a heart condition and would have these attacks of hiccuping, which would go on sometimes for hours, sometimes for days. And the doctors of the surrounding area, Honestapel was not exactly a great metropolis, but the doctors of that area, that region, were convinced that this was very dangerous for his heart. So on one occasion, when this condition persisted for days, they rushed him into Kiev, which was a number of hours' ride from Honestapel, where there was a great professor. Came into the professor, the specialist, and he examined him, and he said to him, well, we have a way of stopping this. This is a hiccuping, is a spasm of the diaphragm. So he said that the way they do this is they heat up a rod, an iron rod, and they put it to the backbone, and the shock stops the hiccuping. So he said, we will have to tie him down to the chair, because the heat is so intense that if I'm to be able to do this, to get close enough to administer the shock, he said, I'll never get close enough to him with this iron rod. He said, I had a Kozak here. A Kozak was, these huge, burly Russian soldiers. He said, I had a Kozak in here yesterday. He said, and he says, I tied him down. He says, and I got just close to him with this iron rod. He said, the shock was so strong, he broke the ropes that bound him to the chair and jumped out the window. So the Rebbe, who didn't understand any Russian, said to my grandfather, who had accompanied him, he said, what did the professor say? What did the specialist say? So he repeated to him. So he said to him, tell him he doesn't have to tie me down, and he doesn't have to worry about me jumping. So the doctor proceeded to heat up the rod, put it up and down his backbone, and Gematala didn't move. So the doctor was certain that something was wrong. He probably did not get close enough. So he heated it up again, and this time did it closer, and the Rebbe didn't move. So he decided that it must be that the rod wasn't hard enough, so he left the rod in the fire until it actually was glowing. Once again, went very close, the Rebbe didn't move. He threw down the rod and exclaimed to my grandfather, said to him, tell him that he must be an angel. He's certainly not a human being. At which point, Padmatala turned to his son and said to him, what did the professor say? So he said, he told me that you're an angel, not a human being. So Padmatala said, how can he understand? He said, when my chassidim come to me with their problems and their tzaras, he says, and there are times when I can't help him, he said, if I don't jump out of my skin from the pain of being unable to help him, so he says, this pain, comparatively speaking, is a child's play. That was the nature of the Rebbe's relationship with his chassidim. What? Huh? Yeah. I don't know if it happened immediately, but it apparently took care of the hiccups. Someone who was to become a chassid of the Matala had to really sign a formal contract. in which he bound himself to the Rebbe, and the Rebbe would not accept everybody to be a chassid. The philosophy of being a chassid implies that there is a spiritual relationship which pre-exists, that there is a configuration here of neshamis that belong together. And it demanded that the Rebbe have the insight into knowing which neshamas did have this kind of kindredship with him and were part of his identity, and those which did not. So on many occasions, people who came to him who wanted to covenant themselves as his chassidim were not admitted. Whereas those who were, in fact, did subscribe to a formal contract, a formal covenant that gave the Rebbe this leave to be able to direct and counsel this person, both beruchnius ubigashmius, both in their spiritual direction and in their worldly concerns. So we will talk next week. Oh no, next week is Hanukkah. Well, maybe I'll tell you. Maybe I'll. It's not Hanukkah. I don't know. I mean, but I'm going to be speaking about Hanukkah in preparation for Hanukkah. But maybe I'll draw in some of the Hannah Stipler comments on Hanukkah and try to bring the two things together. We'll see how that works out. And then there are a host of fascinating stories that I'd like to share with you about Gematala. It's the kinds of stories which most of which come to me firsthand from either my father or were repeated to my brothers by my grandfather. Here and there I met people who were personal witnesses to some of these events. So these are all really magnificent stories of a person who's bigger than life. So we will continue, God willing, for another session or two on Gematala.